And so a group of us opposed that resolution. And that got us into a lot of trouble. That got us into the ethnic media. My personal information was shared. My parents were extremely upset to the point where they stopped talking to me for a little bit, right? And they also felt like maybe I was being brainwashed or that I was like not coming to these values on my own terms. And I think that's something that they were grappling with, like how could my daughter have such views that are so different from mine?
Hello there, I'm Yonka Kamara. Welcome to Kume Turning Point Diaries, where we share stories of critical moments in our personal and professional lives. Before we dive into this week's conversation, I want to send my heartfelt condolences to the families mourning loved ones who tragically lost their lives to anti-Asian attacks in Georgia last week. At a time like this, where there's a call for accountability around anti-Asian sentiments and racist violence acts, we need to elevate the voices of Asian people. This week, we have a timely conversation with Carolyn Tran, a single mom running for New York City Council in District 25, my hometown of Queens. The daughter of refugees from Vietnam, Carolyn shares her journey of developing her own politics and values in college, working behind the scenes as a public servant for the last 12 years, and now boldly running for office. Carolyn's story is a powerful testimony of daring to challenge the status quo. Hello, Carolyn. Welcome to Kume Turning Point Diaries. I'm so excited to have you. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me on here. I'm really excited to spend the next hour or so sharing stories and be in conversation with you and your father.
So for our listeners, Carolyn is a mama of two, among many other things. She's also a candidate for New York City Council District 25, which is my hometown of Jackson Heights. So I'm thrilled to be in conversation with her today to learn more about her personal story, her platform, and the vision she has for our community and the country as a whole. So thank you, Carolyn, for making time to speak with me. I'm curious to know what moment was the awakening of your political activism?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, like, it's been, when I look back kind of like from the last, I want to say like 15, 20 years to where I am now, it definitely has been a journey. And I feel like all of that has kind of like built up to where I am now. I am the daughter of refugees from Vietnam. And if people are familiar kind of like with that history, you know, the majority of the Vietnamese community here in the United States is very conservative, right? And I would say probably the most reactionary of all Asian Americans. I believe that like 51% of our community voted for Trump. So growing up, you had to kind of like get in line with those type of views and values. And as I got older and started developing my own politics and values, it was definitely in contrast to what I was seeing in my community. And so like that was, I feel like maybe the first part of when I started to really discover like my political voice, I would say. But when I went to college, you know, I started to take courses in like ethnic studies and really learn about like the rich history of activism in the Bay Area, where I went to college. So I learned about the Black Panthers. I learned about the Third World Liberation Front. And like those movements inspired me. I want to say like that was probably when I really felt like that was where I felt my political home was, and really my orientation to movements and to politics, and really like how I approach government and community organizing. And so when I moved to New York 12 years ago, I brought that type of values and spirit with me in terms of, you know, I see the limitations of government, and I don't believe that government is the end all to change, right? But it is a tool that we must utilize because it is part of our system. So for me, my approach has always been, you know, letting communities and letting movements and people lead, and that government should do that work for the people. And so like I would say like that's kind of my my way that I've addressed and really like my political analysis. And that has just sharpened over the last couple of years. I think especially this past year that we've seen in our country, or maybe the last 4 years with Trump coming into office, right? Like people realizing that you can't ignore local government, or you can't ignore, you know, these systems, because they all play a role. And I think that's, you know, having Trump was a mistake for our country, but it really did awaken so many people and made people so aware of the things that they chose to ignore. And so I think we're in a very exciting place for the city. You know, this year we have 35 out of the 51 council seats termed out. We have an election for the mayor, comptroller, several borough presidents races. So there's going to be a huge shift in the way that this city runs. And so we have an opportunity to really have our voice in how that new shift changes. And that's exciting to me.
And that's exciting to me as well, as a native New Yorker. I want you to take us a little bit back. You mentioned that you are the child of Vietnamese refugees. Can you tell us a little bit more about your childhood so that we can better understand your political awakening?
Yeah, definitely. For my family story, you know, they left because they were going to be persecuted. My parents did not know each other in Vietnam. They both actually left Vietnam. My mom was one of the millions of boat people who escaped by boat. And they both landed in refugee camps in different countries, was there for a little bit before they both ended up actually in Hawaii. And that's actually where they met, you know, and with being, you know, refugees and being new immigrants, my mom's first job was working in nail salons or cutting hair. And my dad installed cable. And that was the only work that they could find with limited education and limited language skills to a brand new country that, you know, they ultimately did not choose to move to. And so for me, you know, kind of understanding that experience, and then also seeing that as a child too, my mom, you know, eventually moved to California, but my mom was able to land a union job. And that really anchored our family, right? My dad worked in multiple jobs, you know, mostly like doing like not engineering, but doing more of like the assembling, you know, like the many work that like immigrants get, right? Not like the brain type of work, but like the labor intensive. And he had difficulty, you know, securing it or keeping that for a long time. You know, I think like in those type of fields, the turnover is quick. You know, if you're at the bottom, you get disposed of so easily. And so seeing that as a child, you know, it really gave me a perspective of like working class immigrants. I really like the struggles when you have limited education and limited language skills to really, you know, maintain work in this country, and really how disposable we are to companies, right? Like when our labor is no longer needed, or if we can find somebody who we can pay less, or we can consolidate, you know, that human value goes out the window. And right, and with that too, it also goes with, you know, the families that they support, the communities that they're embedded in. And so, you know, for me, you know, seeing my parents as a young child struggle with those type of employment issues, but then also, you know, I think the key thing too is that my mom's job was really the stabilizing force in our family, even after my dad was like laid off and could not secure employment. My mom's work in a union really was our only source of income, right? And to this day, like, you know, my parents have ascended into middle class. You know, they have a home, they're pretty comfortable, even though, you know, it's my mom's income that is the one that is providing for our family, you know. And that as now, like, you know, my sisters and I help as much as we can, but that definitely gave me a perspective of of workers in this country, and really like, and how that intersects with immigration and gender, right? And like for my mom's experience as well, how she became the sole income provider for our family.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, I can imagine having that kind of upbringing, right, instills in you a different kind of understanding of the world and realities, right, of people, especially working class people. I want you to really elaborate a little bit more for our listeners, right, because here are people, your folks and many other Vietnamese people who immigrated here to the U.S. who have faced oppression back in their country, right, and then they come to this country and they are facing oppression, but somehow they may not view it as oppression. How did you see your parents justify or reconcile like the oppression that they faced back home versus the oppression that they're facing here? Was there any reconciliation in understanding that? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that completely makes sense. And I think like that is, you know, something that a lot of our immigrant communities that we struggle with, right, as like maybe second generation children who have a better understanding about, you know, U.S. systems and kind of like the impacts of that, and how do we connect that with our parents' generation who maybe don't have the language or really the education about that. I've had this conversation with my parents, particularly very recently after the attack on the Capitol, and seeing that there was a large crowd of Vietnamese people with the white supremacists, basically, and like really talking about how that has really impacted our community and why we can't really be silent. And in my conversations with my mom, I had asked her, like, did you ever see, you know, a problem before? Like, did you ever notice that, like, you know, that white supremacists don't really value Vietnamese people like as equals, right? Even though like, you know, our community is like ready to throw down with them and stand in support with them. Like, do you not realize that like we're not seen in that as equals with them? And had you ever thought about that before? And she said, no, you know, and I think that disconnect has been because we've been so attached to this idea of like what it means to be successful in this country, right? Like we work hard, we can buy a house, you know, we have nice cars, you know, we have nice things, right? Like that is like what we attain to. But then there's all this other stuff that's like happening and that, you know, people choose to kind of ignore it. But we couldn't these last couple of years, right? Because, you know, Trump was also like still attacking our communities, even like, you know, saying, you know, like the COVID was a Chinese virus, even though we're Vietnamese, right? Like we're not immune to those attacks. Like we're just seen as Asians, right? Or as foreigners to white supremacists, right? They don't know the difference between Vietnamese, Chinese, or, you know, any other ethnicity. And so I think like these last 4 years has really been an awakening for our community, and that it just really shows that like there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And in those conversations with my parents, like, it's like me kind of forcing them to really like think about like, you know, how are we being complicit with white supremacy in our community? And like, how do we give people context to their lives about like, you know, why we need minimum livable wage, not just $8.25. Like who can really afford that, right? Or why we need protections for workers, you know, why we need immigration reform, comprehensive immigration reform, right? Like within the, I think oftentimes people don't realize like within the Asian American communities, Southeast Asians have the highest numbers of deportation. You know, Vietnamese people and Cambodians, Laotian Hmong people are being deported at high numbers in our community, and nobody talks about that, right? And so we're not immune to any of the oppressive systems that this country, you know, provides, right? And so we shouldn't live in a world where we pretend that we're above that. And so I think like having conversations has been really eye-opening to me with my family and with my parents. And then like really kind of like giving them context to their lives and how like these systems impact them.
you describe yourself as a bold leftist. Can you tell us what that means to you? And if there was a particular moment where it solidified for yourself, right, this idea of bold, you know, a leftist.
To be Vietnamese, to be, to say you support maybe like socialist ideas, or to even identify as a socialist is to be very bold. The particular time when like, you know, it was like, I had to really take a risk was there was, I believe, a resolution in California to establish a different flag as the official flag of the Vietnamese community in California, which was not the flag of Vietnam, right? And knowing like the politics of Vietnam, you know, our community identifies with one that's not the actual flag, right? And so a group of us opposed that resolution. And that got us into a lot of trouble. That got us into the ethnic media. My personal information was shared. My parents were extremely upset to the point where they stopped talking to me for a little bit, right? And then also with that, they also felt like maybe I was being brainwashed or that I was like not coming to these values on my own terms, right? And I think that's something that they were grappling with, like how could my daughter, right, have such views that are so different from mine? And so I feel like, you know, in college when I started to sharpen my analysis really about like racism and sexism and like where those isms were rooted in, right? A lot, for me, it was rooted in white supremacy. And then thinking about how does that extend to like different parts of the world and really like, you know, our history and our current events. And so that was like my political awakening or like a critical moment when I had to be bold, knowing that stepping into this public space and opposing something that the majority of my community really felt passionately about was a huge risk that I would take, you know, for my own like safety, for my family's like reputation, right? And that I would say like that's probably the first bold thing that I did.
Is there another particular moment where you were really stepping into your identity as a bold leftist Vietnamese woman, and regardless of who was behind you, you were going to be this person?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say like starting maybe not with my politics, but like last year, I had decided to separate from my partner, the father of my children, who I had been with for 14 years, right? And like that was a struggle in itself, because like, you know, I don't have like family here, you know, luckily I had a job that paid well, but like to kind of decide like, no, like, I cannot this festering inside of my spirit. Like if I continue to do this, you know, there will always be that voice like, Carolyn, like you're not listening to your heart, or you're not listening to like, you know, your intuition. And so like to say like, okay, I'm going to do this, even though I know that it's going to be difficult for my family. And then really try to build like a good co-parent relationship, I think like was like kind of like maybe like the first step in this kind of path like this year. And so when I finally felt like, okay, I'm gonna do this in terms of my campaign, it was really because I had the support and encouragement of community organizers that I really respected in this district, right? I think without them, I would've been like, oh, I don't know, like I'm gonna be going against up like so many, you know, things that like, you know, somebody who's more polished, has more money, has more institutional support, this is gonna be difficult for somebody like me. But in doing so, it also gave me an opportunity to be like, you know what, like now I don't have to be, if I'm gonna run, I'm gonna be unfiltered, unwavering and unapologetic about what I represent, right? I think for so long, for the last couple of years, I've had to really compromise that because I was in the passenger seat, right? I had to kind of put that aside to support the leadership of somebody else. And so deciding to do this, running my campaign, was then to be like, okay, if I'm gonna throw my hat in, like you cannot like back away from who you are. Like you're only gonna win if you are your authentic 100% who you are. And that is, do not be afraid of your politics, even if it seems like, you know, unpopular, or that you would get pushback from, like, you know, your community at all. And so, you know, I think like my politics have always really been there, but to be like open about it, I feel like this campaign gave me that opportunity. And so running was maybe like that decision, like that one, that when I struck out, and was like, when I decided I was going to do it, it was, I was going to do it and bring my values and my politics with me. It wasn't just like, okay, I'm going to run and then like kind of hide it. Cause I think oftentimes we see that, right? We see like candidates who like kind of stray away from things that might be controversial in terms of like their beliefs or like things that won't get them votes. But I'm not doing that for, I'm not running because of that. I'm not running so that I could get the votes, you know, from like, what is popular or what is like acceptable. I'm running because I want to provide a space for somebody who has my values, who look like me, who has my experience, to say like, we also can operate. We can also be in these, in politics, and win.
I commend you for your bravery and really walking into your fear, but having your values guide you. I think that's so important. Too often, you know, we let fear overwhelm us and take over and actually keep us from pursuing the things we want, versus actually it being the motivation. There was a talk I was listening to, and it's like, if you're doing something that doesn't scare you a little bit, it means that it's, you're not really doing your best, right? You're not living bold. And I think it's so beautiful, again, to commend you on being fearless. You know, it being fearless does not mean you don't have fear. It just means like, despite the fear, you're moving forward with it. So would you like to say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, like, it, in my like kind of path, you know, like thinking before I got to this place where I really decided, it was, you know, that I think that fear held me back a little bit. And then recognizing like, well, what are you afraid of, Carolyn, right? Like, you know, you're going to be out of a job this year anyways, right? And so like, what do you have to lose? Yes, it's scary. Yes, you're going to come up against like things that don't want you to run, or that, you know, there's just so many factors, right? But I just really had to sit with that fear and then recognize, like, if I'm feeling like this, it also means that this is the right decision. If it's risky, if it feels like, you know, like I always say, like, there were so many things that told me not to run that I knew I had to run. And I think it was a big part of that was the fear, right? Like, you know, like the fear of like losing, the fear of like putting my family through this stress, the fear of like, you know, everything. But that should not hold me back, right? If anything, those should be the driving, motivating factors, right? I need to show my daughters like our role is not always behind the scenes or behind the desk, and that their mom can also shift, that we can also shift as well. And that to my family too, right? Like to my parents, like, yes, like I'm sure they never thought in their wildest dream that they would be leaving a country, coming to America, and that their daughter would then be running for office in New York City, right? On such a national, I would say, like, even though it's a local race, it's, you know, it's a national platform as well, right? People are always looking at New York City. And so, you know, they probably never imagined that, you know? Yeah, I never imagined that for myself, right?
Was there a particular moment where you decided like, I need to run, or this is why I need to run?
Yeah. So, you know, I started 12 years ago in the council member's office as an intern. And that was, you know, I was in grad school at New School doing urban policy, and they required us to do an internship. And so I actually did not live in the district. I lived in Woodside. And I was looking at, you know, the different electeds that I could possibly apply for. And I was really pull towards this current council member, and like the values that he represented and like his leadership really resonated with me. And so I was able to land an internship, and then I basically have worked my way up to be the chief of staff for the last 5 years. And in that time, you know, like I had mentioned, like I always knew government had its limitations, but I also like really enjoyed the community service side and interacting with the constituents, the community organizations, and just neighbors who are trying to access city government to help their lives. And I wanted to be kind of like that connector and making sure that like our office was providing that resource. And also just before landing it, I was also, there's a lot of great base building organizations in the district. You know, I would say like probably like the premier groups, like right in New York City. And so like to be able to work in an office in partnership with them was also very exciting to me. And so, you know, I think 12 years is a long time to be in city government. I've been able to really see the inner workings and like how government can leverage its resources, but also its limitations, right? And failures as well. And so I would say probably in the last, you know, I think ever since Trump, things kind of shifted where it was like, we have to be critical in all aspects of our lives, even in the position that we hold. We cannot just function how we have been, right? Even if we think that we are progressive or we're on the left, like that has not shown us that it's gotten us anywhere, right? And so it was for me like, all right, now we got to like be a little bit more sharper in the ways that we do things, in the ways that we think. And then I just, you know, for me, I started to see a shift also in city leadership and in the leadership of our own district that really differed from my own values. And that was like a struggle for me for a little bit, because one part, like, you know, I really respected and valued the work of my boss. And then the other part was like, but then I also have my own values that I was also trying to grapple with. And then on top of that, because of capitalism, you know, I have to work, right? And so, you know, it was a really difficult time these last couple of years that I've really just had to really internalize and figure it out on my own. And I would say I try to push as much as I could on the inside. And when I realized that I couldn't really move things, then I went straight to the people. I went straight to organizations and you know, the organizers, and try to like really work on that end and be like, you know, our values like align here. So like, use me. How can I be of help to you while I am in this position, right? And this probably has also like led me to, you know, my current situation a little too. And so, you know, like I think the last 12 years has been a really wonderful opportunity for me to kind of learn government, and then, you know, seeing also how machine politics really play out, right? As much as we say as progressives, like we're not for that or we don't participate in that, you know, I think power always gets to us, right? And how do we elect people that don't embody that? And so like after speaking with like a lot of community organizers and just really encouraging them to run, you know, I really wanted to see a woman of color. I wanted to see somebody who was rooted in our community or was born here and grew up in these streets, in this neighborhood, to come into this race. And nobody wanted to do it. But at the same time, people were pushing me. And I would say I was a hesitant, reluctant candidate, because why would a single mom of two with remote learners, you know, and living in a pandemic want to do that, right? Like, I think like I could have just lived with my head in the clouds, lived a happy life, but just live a very comfortable life. But inside of me, things were also shifting too. And I just also felt like if there was ever going to be a place where a leftist Vietnamese American single mom was going to run and had a great chance, that would be in District 25. And so I decided to throw my hat in, really, because how many times do we see women, particularly women of color, always get overlooked for work, right? You know, I can do the job, but if I want to come into my own lane, you know, like that's not welcome, right? Or supported or encouraged. And then oftentimes when we talk about work and what we value, right, it's never the behind the scenes labor. It's never the people who are doing the work to keep things running, right? It's the people who are front facing, who can say the polished words, who, you know, give you like the perfect sound bites, right? That we value as work. And so I wanted to push back against that as well. I feel like this campaign is also a direct dismantling of that, right? Like a woman who's worked in the office for the last 12 years in support of another, in support of a man who has an idea of who he wants to be the next person, who is another man, right? But then at the same time, who has been really doing the work? And then now with like the termination, right? Like really just further proves that and kind of like the attacks that I have been receiving since then too. It's just, politics in New York City is already crazy in itself. And like, I did not want to be a part of that, right? And I think that's also why a lot of people don't want to run. And we were trying to really just run a very clean race, and we still intend to, but it just kind of really shows you that like, it's not so easy, right? You can't just say, I want to run for office and then think that like, people are not going to try to tear you down along that way.
Speaking of tearing down, because you just mentioned about the termination, would you like to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So initially when I had shared with him that I wanted to run, he was really shocked, right? And he has said to me that I never knew you were into politics, right? And after, you know, like working a decade in the field, it felt a little shocking to also, like hurtful to hear that as well, right? Because, you know, I think like, maybe like a month or so before, you know, he was encouraging me to take a position as an executive assistant. And at that point, I would say I probably realized that after 12 years of service, like that was really all that he amounted me to, right? And not wanting to encourage or push me to be the next level in my career, but kind of keep me at the same level, right? And you know, I didn't push back. I felt like I felt like I wish I did, right? To ask, like why would you ask? Why would you offer me a position like that? And so when I first told him, he was shocked. But I think like that's just kind of an extension of where he was coming from, right? Thinking that like this came out of nowhere, right? Because all I was really to him was a personal assistant. And then he kind of just stopped talking to me, right? And it was, you know, like, if it was not clear before, it was more apparent now that it was only really my labor that was needed, right? And so when I try to ask to like have a conversation about the campaign, no response. When I emailed, no response. And so, but the only time that he would communicate with me was when he needed me to do work, right? And I think maybe some would argue, say, but that's all that he needs to communicate with you, right? Like he doesn't need to talk to you about the campaign. But, you know, like you would think that after being with somebody for 12 years, right? Like really supporting their leadership and really doing the work to uplift them and make sure that things are going fine, you would be treated with a little bit more respect, right? And so we have had conversations. You know, it wasn't ever about, I never asked, you know, for an endorsement because I understood that was not going to ever happen, right? But just to, you know, be encouraged, like, I think you have a great chance, Carolyn. You know, I'm in a difficult situation because I'm invested in somebody else already. But like, you know, I wish you the best and I will not get in your way, right? And so it's been a very surreal last couple of 3 months. You know, I think running a campaign is also difficult. But then when the termination came on Tuesday, that was a very hurtful experience, right? That termination happened in less than a 30-second call. And to me, it was like, after 12 years, like, it could just be finished like that, right? And that's, I think, like, and the messed up thing too was like, in a couple of hours, I had an event that I needed to do for the campaign. So like to process and like kind of like sit with that, I didn't really have that opportunity. And so I think like for all of us who have ever been like disposed of like that, or who have ever felt like devalued, I think that trauma sits with you for a long time, right? And I think it'll come up like in or you get triggered in different moments of your life. But to me, like, I just have to see that, you know, as like we have said, one door closes, another door opens, right? And like, there's no, for me, there's no reason to waste any tears over it or spend any energy into that, right? I think like, yes, I should take time to like process it and sit with that feelings and lean in on it. But I should also then use that to kind of motivate me as well, right? And really, like, in any struggle, we just have to continue to rise above it and push through. And so, you know, it's still fresh. You know, I think when I talk about it, sometimes I just kind of resign with it. Like, well, what can I do, right? Like, that was probably going to come anyways, right? And then other times, like, I'm still, like, you know, really hurt and upset by it. But I just have to keep pushing through.
Yeah, I think I agree. I agree that this is definitely like a turning point for you, and that you're living it right now. And it might take a while for you to really see the culmination of this turning point, but it is going to be something for your life. Did you at any point regret running when that happened?
No, I don't regret running. I mean, I feel like this week has been very surreal. And like has been like an emotional roller coaster. You know, I mean, in the moment that it happened, I was very hurt, very traumatized, right? Because it's also the first job that I've ever been terminated at, you know, in my career. And thinking about how, you know, I started as an intern, really helped build this office and this work. Then to also be let go in like really 30 seconds and in such a hurtful way. But then I kind of had to put that away, because then I still have to focus on the campaign, that I still also have to like focus on my daughters. Right. And, you know, so I feel like, I don't know, I just feel detached a little as well, you know, and not try to be too invested in that moment, but I need to tap into that sometimes too, because I think that's a powerful place. Like when I tell my story, when I'm trying to explain what happened to people. But I don't regret running. I think if anything, this just proves to me more why, you know, like people like me needs to run, right? You know, and I think like if I felt like this was a mistake, then they would have won, right? Even if like I don't drop out, just letting those type of thinking like seep into my brain at the moment will then like distract me from the larger goal, right? And like to me, like the seat represents more than just me, right? It's not just me like running so that I can have another job, right? But it represents like the people that are invested in this campaign, who are, I want to say, like 98% women of color from the neighborhood, who don't see themselves as campaign consultants, or maybe they've never worked on campaigns before, but they believe in like the mission of this campaign and what we represent. And are investing their time into it, right? And then also the people that we do have as paid staff, right? And these are people that are working class, everyday people who have never like maybe interfaced with politics before. Like one of our community organizer is a single mom from our local homeless shelter. And, you know, and oftentimes, like, I really feel like when we talk about like issues, Like, we always leave out the people who are impacted, right? Like, we like to talk above people's heads, but we never actually ask, if you had an opportunity, how would you change this policy? How do you think, what is meaningful housing policy that the city can implement from the perspective of somebody who's actually impacted by a housing crisis, right? I cannot let those feelings like really deter me, because it's so much more than just me, right? Like, it's, this campaign is not about Carolyn winning so that she can have a job. It's about Carolyn winning so that our communities are centered or at the forefront of this, right? I'm just the conduit. I'm just the face of it. And really, like, it's the community that is supporting the campaign that I need to make sure is always on the forefront of this campaign and like why we do what we're doing.
What do you want people to know about your campaign?
I want them to know that, you know, it's not just me, it's a coalition and a community of us, right? And that we are really just trying to change the way that politics has been done here in New York City, right? Like, even like reframing, like, because people will ask, what is your issue? Like, what is the one issue that you're fighting for? And I always say, we're not single issue people. We do not live single issue lives. And so at the core of us, we're like trying to really emphasize the importance of intersectionality, right? And I hope that people really take that away, that like our lives are so connected to so many systems, and that like a woman's issue is an immigration issue, is a housing issue, and that we really need to approach issues and policies in that way. I hope that people take away that like this campaign represents like a radical Southeast Asian feminist perspective that we have not ever seen in politics before, that we're unapologetic about being a feminist or being radical or being Southeast Asian. And then at the core of it is that, you know, we're not running because we're anti anybody or anti anything, is that love is really at the core of this campaign, right? Like, we love our community so much that we want to see something better for ourselves and for our neighbors and for our kids. We're trying to change the way that local politics is being run, right? And I think, like I had mentioned earlier, that it sometimes feels like it's an act of dismantling patriarchy just by existing and being out there, right? But we're just resisting against so many things because we have such a strong love for our people. And that I hope that is really conveyed in our campaign.
And what are you most proud of your campaign so far, or just even running?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I'm most proud of the team, of the support that we have. You know, I think building a world that we are fighting for is being reflected in the campaign, right? Like, I've always been so adamant that like the leadership of the campaign should be led by women of color, by LGBTQIA individuals, from young people, right? And oftentimes that work is hard, like finding people who share your values and also believe in that type of leadership too is difficult, especially if you're also like now then hyper like localizing it too, like, no, they have to be from Elmhurst or Jackson Heights, right? But I know our people are out there, and we just have to put in that extra work to look for them and give them the opportunity. That is probably what I'm most proud of, is the team and the support that has gotten behind this campaign. Because we're just everyday people. We're not, you know, campaign consultants. You know, we're not doing this for a living or as a hustle. But these are people who are community organizers. They're mothers or they're professionals who are invested in this campaign because they want to see something different for our neighborhood.
Well, I'm very, very excited for you. And I'm excited, you know, to be talking to somebody who's running for office in my neighborhood. I no longer live in Jackson Heights, but my parents are still there. So I'm very much invested in the future of that community, a community that deserves more than it sometimes gets. And you have now made that your home. Can you share with us what you love most about living in Jackson Heights?
Such a loving community, right? Like a village. And especially like being a single parent too, like having that support system, it has been so vital, especially during a pandemic too. And I just love like the vibrancy, the hustle of our neighborhood. And I love Elmhurst too. Like I never want to forget Elmhurst. And just how much of a village we are in like such a big city. Like we have that community feel. So you can walk down the neighborhood and see like, you know, one or two neighbors all the time and like people actually stopping and talking to you. And it's such a warm community despite all the different things that are happening, right? I feel like this district is such a embodiment of what this country could be.
But this new administration is constantly talks about unity, right? So how do you think we can be united in a way that is not superficial?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is like a great question. I think like that's in like neoliberal spaces, like we always talk about like unity, but it's like very superficial, right? It's just like, oh, let's just make sure like we have like a Black person there, an Asian person there, right? But it's like not really recognizing kind of like the difference, right? And I think like recognizing our communities different is also a powerful thing to do to help us bring each other together, right? Because we can then find kind of like the similarities in that and recognize like not all of us are treated equally, right? Like even within like people of color, like, you know, it's not just like, yes, all people of color should be treated the same because not all of us come from the same type of experience. And so recognizing that, I think like for our community, there definitely is, you know, two parts of the district, right? There's Jackson Heights, which, you know, is a lot more organized, is a lot more engaged civically, and maybe a little bit more affluent, I would say, than Elmhurst, the part of our district, right? And so I think like the unity part is welcoming all of us into a space and making sure that like all of us can participate, right? Even if we come from different values and different backgrounds. And so for me, like language justice is a huge part of this campaign where, you know, we believe that like English should not be the central form of communication in our spaces because not all of us speak English or, you know, that's not what we all speak at home as well. And so making sure that like our spaces, we have interpretation that we're translating, but also that spirit of like, we don't have to be divided if you and I don't share the same language, right? Like we could still share our values and our community despite not speaking the same language. And so finding like those type of connections as well. And I think our district does somewhat of, we celebrate diversity, right? But then, you know, celebration is one, but like, let's actually like implement that, right? And so like, how are we also celebrating the different groups in our district and bringing other people to learn and also celebrate about that is important. You know, I think curriculum, like you have said, like, you know, the power of not feeling like othered, I think is so important for young people in our community, right? That should also be reflected in our curriculum in schools and in our teachers and our administration of like, who's our nurses, who's our principals, who are our like, you know, who works in facilities of our schools. I think like unity is letting those who are least recognized and maybe most oppressed be at the forefront of these conversations, right? I think having that perspective and having that leadership gives us a different nuance of what we think about in terms of unity, right? Because oftentimes if it's going to be middle class or college educated, affluent people who occupy these spaces, right? It's not diverse and it's not going to bring us together. So I think we need to let those who are, you know, and I think oppression comes in different levels, but those who have less access to resources or where inequities really fail among our communities to be at the forefront of leading those conversations.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Carolyn, for making time and to sharing your story and your vision with me today. I truly, truly appreciate it. Can you tell us a date? Because I think that's also important. You know, people get mail, but sometimes they don't look at the mail and they have to hear it. So can you tell us the important thing we need to know? When to come out?
Yes.
And vote.
Definitely. So if you want to learn more about the campaign too, like my website is www.carolyntran.us. And the primary is on June 22nd. So in a couple of months. And because this is a district that is heavily Democratic, whoever wins the primary will most likely also then win the general election in November. So June 22nd is the big date.
Okay, June 22nd. Okay, well, thank you. I'll make sure to include that date as well on the notes, the show notes, and obviously post about it on our page and website and whatnot. So, but thank you again. I truly, truly appreciate you making time for me and just being generous with your story. I think there's something in that, you know, you could have chosen to be in on any platform, but you chose to be on here, and for that, I'm forever grateful. And where can we find you on social media? What's your social media handle?
Thank you. So all of my social media handle is I am Carolyn Tran. Yeah.
And do you have any last words for our listeners?
Yeah, no. I mean, I want to thank you first for actually, you know, like, you know, for giving me this opportunity too, right? And I think you could have also picked anybody else to have on your show, but you know, I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to kind of share about like my path and the campaign. And I also want to say, you know, in closing, like, you know, don't dismiss like people like that you don't, that are unexpected, right? And I think that's also part of this, like, you know, nobody expected me to come out of anywhere and run for office. And so there's power in everybody, and that, you know, we should always recognize it and elevate it when possible. And don't be, if you're feeling like, you know, in despair after this year, really with the pandemic, or just feeling like lonely, like, you know, There is a whole community, a whole support system out there, right? And we are here really to say that we're not alone. We're not just doing this by ourselves, you know, that we are a community of people like rooted in love and care and accountability. And that, you know, we hope that you will just also join us on this journey too. Like, you know, this is not the last time you'll hear about this campaign or really about us, but hope that you will also, like, you know, we like to say grab a chair and have a seat at our table.
Yeah, I love that. Well, thank you again, and best of luck
for the
campaign. And we look forward to hopefully celebrating.
Okay. Yes, definitely. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Take care.
Bye.
Carolyn's story demonstrates that there is a price to pay for speaking up and doing the right thing. She has paid the price twice. First, when she broke away from the politics and values of her family, and later when she decided to run for office and her boss didn't support her aspirations. I am very moved by Carolyn's courage in these situations. In the midst of everything that's happening in this country, here's an Asian woman running for office and fighting for her community and our community. Join me in supporting Carolyn in her run for New York City Council for District 25. Hey y'all, thank you for tuning in. Please remember to subscribe, leave a review, and share the episode. Be sure to also follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Turning Point Diaries. Kume, until next time.
theme music by Exile Dynamics featuring Mo Fox.